Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs Committee to order, Thursday, February 8th. Max Gruenberg, from the Alaska Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Ledoux. Representative Birch.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Tuck. Representative Josephson, alternate. Representative Knopf.
Here.
Representative Wolf. Representative Kopp, alternate. Chair Christ Hopkins.
Here, with four members present, we have the bare minimum to conduct business. Four bills on today's agenda, HCR 2, second hearing, HB 168, and companion legislation HCR 10, second hearing, and HJR 31, second hearing. And if it's the will of the committee, we'll take action on all four pieces of legislation. And public testimony also associated with many of these pieces of legislation. First item on the agenda is HCR 2. The bill was introduced in committee last week, and I'm going to bring it back before, and public testimony was noticed today. I failed to mention HB 224, which I believe some people in the room are here for. So starting with HCR 2, I'm going to open public testimony and start with those online. Opening public testimony. 2 minutes. Starting farthest north in Anchorage, Samantha Savage, if you can hear us, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Thank you. My name is Samantha Savage with the Fairbanks Wellness Coalition and the Fairbanks North Star Borough. Our coalition's purpose is to foster wellness through primary prevention advocacy. Our two current projects right now are focused on suicide prevention and heroin and prescription opioid misuse among teens and young adults. We recognize that it's important as a community and as a state to work together to prevent trauma, because childhood trauma has an enormous impact on the issues that we as a coalition seek to prevent. According to Linda Chamberlain, the director of the Alaska Violence Prevention Project, she has shared that, that studies have shown that nearly two-thirds of suicide attempts in adults were attributed to ACEs, and nearly 80% of suicide attempts during childhood and adolescence were attributed to ACEs. And we also know from research gathered by the Alaska Children's Trust that a person with four or more ACEs is 12 times more likely to attempt suicide and 10 times more likely to use injection drugs. And so as a coalition, we support state efforts to recognize childhood trauma as an important factor in building wellness in our community. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Savage. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for taking the time to testify today. Next, in Anchorage, Elsie Bordeaux with Alaska Resilience Initiative and Arctic Winds, Healing Winds. Ms. Bordeaux, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Hi, my name is Elsie Boudreaux, and I am on the steering committee for the Alaska Resilience Initiative and also the president of Arctic Winds, Healing Winds, which is a nonprofit organization to bring healing and wellness to villages throughout Alaska. I am Alaska Native. I grew up in the village of St. Mary's, and I really believe, I'm basically calling in support of HCR 2, and I'm urging the committee to support this House bill. It's really important basically to establish statewide policy, being that so much of our Alaska Native children are in foster care, and we know many of the reasons as to why that is because of adverse childhood experiences and historical trauma. And it would be really important to create funding to research statewide solutions. I think it's imperative at this point in our history as Alaska Native people and as people of the state of Alaska, we need to really come together and create solutions that are effective and that are meaningful and will make a difference in the lives of our children so that the adverse childhood experiences are no longer prevalent. And we know all too well how devastating that is, and it creates more havoc for all of us in the state of Alaska, and I think it's imperative that the governor and this committee support HCR2 to the fullest. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bedreau, for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Representative Birch.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony this afternoon. I had just kind of a general question on kind of the, shall we say, the cultural differences between, the foster home process where, you know, a child might graduate from high school in Anchorage after being in maybe a dozen different foster homes, whereas in some rural locations, a child might move upriver or downriver with a family and just kind of stay with that family until they reach adulthood. And my sense is that there's kind of a prevalence of opinion that the child is always better off in the, natural birth family as opposed to in a foster. I'd just be interested in your observations on, how we might be able to do a better job in that regard.
I appreciate your question. And as a social worker, I worked for the Division of Family and Youth Services way back when it was before it was OCS, Office of Children's Services. And the majority of the time, we saw a lot of children in foster care who, no matter, they always wanted to go back to their family. And I think children that grow up closer to their cultural connections do better in the long run, because it's almost like they're no longer seeking, who am I in this world, right? They have a connection to their culture and who they are and where they come from. And I think it's really important for all children, all families, to know who we are and where we've come from. Those children do a lot better staying connected to their culture. And I think, the foster care requirements, I think it would be important for the state to look at those, particularly in rural communities, to be more, I wouldn't say lenient in the requirements, but culturally humble in a sense, to where they're creating safety beyond just the presentation of the home. They're looking at other factors that influence a child's well-being, to include cultural, spiritual, and so, yeah. I don't know if that answered your question.
Follow up. Well, thank you. I certainly agree. I think the cultural continuation, I just know that, folks might end up in a situation where they get raised by an aunt or an uncle or an extended family member, in a nearby area, but that's just kind of where they stay, and there's no big push to remove them and have them go back into what might not be a good environment. And I do appreciate your testimony and your observations this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Moving next online, Laura Norton Cruz in Anchorage. Ms. Norton Cruz, could you please put yourself on the record and present your testimony?
Yes, and I was joined in the room by Josh Arvidson, the director of the Alaska Child Trauma Center. Would it be okay if he testified first and I went after him?
Go ahead, and please just put on record, Josh, before you testify.
Hi, this is Josh Arvidson. I'm the director of the Alaska Child Trauma Center, the Anchorage Community Mental Health Services, and I'm on the steering committee for the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. And I just wanted to provide testimony in support of this legislation today. I wanted to speak to the emerging science around adverse childhood experiences and childhood traumatic stress. The adverse childhood experiences studied in data is now 20 years mature and has been supported by follow-up research that really highlights the link between adverse childhood experiences and long-term outcomes across health, mental health, substance abuse education and occupational outcomes. I think it's very critical for us as a state to have a systematic approach to addressing this issue. I think it will have financial and health benefits for the state of Alaska and all of our residents. The final thing that I would like to say is that in the subsequent 20 years since this research originally occurred, the emerging science of traumatic stress and a better understanding of how traumatic stress impacts the behavior and even the physiology and brain, imaging studies and research really has directed us to effective interventions and approaches that can help us achieve better outcomes for Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Norton-Cruz, if you're there as well, please go ahead and testify.
Okay, thanks. Thank you all for your time today. My name is Laura Norton-Cruz, and I'm the director of the Alaska Resilience Initiative, which is a statewide network that's housed at the Children's Trust. And I'm calling in from my home community of Anchorage to support HCR2. In my director role, but also as a former teacher and as the mother of young children and as a community member, I support this resolution because I hold a value, and it's a value I know that you and I share, that all of our children in Alaska deserve to be safe and cared for, that all of our children deserve the opportunity to grow into healthy adults who can contribute to their communities. You've already heard really powerful testimony on Tuesday and today from others on the science basis, so I'm going to concentrate on why we at the Alaska Resilience Initiative view this particular resolution as a vital part of the solution. So as a director of the statewide network of people who are actively addressing ACEs, it's my job to learn about and help people connect people to the efforts that are already happening across Alaska. And there are hundreds of groups that are using this ACEs and trauma lens to guide their work. And they've been doing this for decades in some cases. In fact, Alaska is at the forefront of this movement in some areas, and it's considered a national leader. For example, we were chosen as one of 14 pilot sites across the country for movement building around ACEs. Alaskan tribes are doing powerful work, including the Aleut community of St. Paul that was today featured in The Guardian. There's a coalition in the Mat-Su Valley that's leading really creative and innovative OCS and court improvements. The Ketchikan shipyard of the international company Vigor is the safest shipyard in the entire company and is the model for the Seattle shipyard because of their implementation of trauma-informed practices. And Alaska has one of the first divisions of juvenile justice in the country that underwent a transformation to be trauma-informed. So Alaskans are creative and innovative. You know, we've really taken this on and we're running with it. And yet, we have so far to go, as you know from the many grim statistics about our child welfare system and medical spending and the opioid crisis and so on. And so in order to make this work across all sectors as effective as possible, what we need is a shared commitment and shared language from the Alaska legislature and the governor to help set the tone and set priorities. In Wisconsin, the way the state has prioritized ACEs and trauma-informed work at the level of state government, in fact, this work is led by First Lady Tenette Walker, has allowed for trauma and resilience work in Wisconsin to flourish across the state. And that's resulted in significant improvements in academic health and social outcomes, as well as radical cost savings for state and local governments.
And Ms. Norton-Cruz, if you could summarize your comments.
Sure. So what this resolution allows you to do is set the tone for new policymakers and new commissioners and say, hey, we here in the Capitol care about this. We use this lens. We know that we need to do this to save our state money and to have a healthy workforce. And we do this because it actually can result in improvements in the major troublesome issues from the opioid epidemic to the child welfare system, et cetera. You setting this tone, you providing this leadership can result in us moving towards an Alaska where our values are manifested. So thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee?
Any questions?
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Laura, for your testimony this afternoon. I appreciate your engagement, and as always, good to hear from you. One question I had, when you begin to, and I'm an engineer, so I'm looking at this, and a parent and a grandparent, but when you relate to adverse childhood experiences, toxic stress, childhood trauma, growing up, I mean, I can remember getting spanked. I can remember, I mean, I've got a lot of significant events that I remember, and some of them were kind of traumatic. I'm sure they had an impact. But is there a measure, or I mean, obviously we certainly are, want to engage in having a positive childhood experience for every child. But how do you gauge that or measure an adverse childhood experience? In the nickel version, if you will.
Sure. Well, one way of thinking about it is like a teeter-totter. So if you have a lot of chronic and persistent stress on one side, that sort of weighs you down and has an effect on your brain and body. But if you have on the other side of the teeter-totter a lot of things that protect you, you know, really supportive adult relationships, meaningful work and engagement in your community, you know, cultural identity, all these other things, that does provide some balance and can be protective against some of the adversity or can help build resilience. And the fulcrum, you know, and then where the fulcrum is might kind of affect which side gets weighted heavier, and that might be something that has to do even with your genetics or things that happen in pregnancy. So there's a lot of factors that play into how someone turns out after they've experienced adversity. You know, the ACE study was a pretty crude measure in that it just said, did these things happen to you? And then they counted the number of those things that happened. But what they found was still incredibly powerful epidemiology, that the more of those things, those adversities that happened, and they measured 10 of them, 5 forms of household dysfunction and 5 forms of child maltreatment, abuse and neglect, what they found is that the more of those things happened to you, the increased risk of, you know, a myriad of health and social problems. But then if you really drill down into it, it isn't absolutely predictive. So just because you have an ACE score of 4 or 5 doesn't mean that you necessarily have problems, because there's also these protective factors and all these other environmental factors that might play in. And so if we use this lens, we can really work on promoting as many of those protective factors as possible and reducing and preventing trauma in the first place.
Follow up. Well, thank you, Laura. Does any of this trauma, stress, or these experiences, do they rise to the point of illegality? I mean, are we talking child abuse here of a physical nature that's reportable and you know, basically punishable, or are we talking lower level, just you know alcoholic problems in the house, what's the range of issues here?
Sure. Well, in the original ACE study that was done at Kaiser Permanente in California, and then those questions were replicated in Alaska, it asks about 5 things that happened to you, and those are all criminal, so physical and emotional neglect and physical, sexual, and verbal abuse, although some of those are easier to substantiate and prosecute than others, and then 5 forms of household dysfunction. So was a household member incarcerated? Did a household member have mental illness? Did a household member have substance abuse? Was there domestic violence in the household? And did parents separate or divorce? So not all of those are criminal, and not all of those in themselves are necessarily a trauma. For example, a divorce may not be in itself traumatic, but what they found is that given the circumstances that might surround it, it could create an environment of stress for the child, of chronic stress for the child. And there are many, many other forms of stress that can affect a child's developing brain and body that are not counted in that study, that other research really points to. For example, bullying can affect a child's development. You know, chronic bullying or chronic discrimination, or hunger.
Great. Well, thank you for the clarification.
Sure. Next testifier, also in Anchorage, is Charles McKee. Mr. McKee, if you can hear us, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
My name is Charles McKee, and with the breath of the Holy Spirit through me, I want to notify you that I'm not a legal fiction. I'm not a fiction. I'm nonfiction, as in Oprah Winfrey's book club. Maybe that's what she's promoting, the definition between this public corporation that I'm referring to, you, this organization and the policy you're talking about. I had a traumatic experience in Fairbanks, Alaska when I was 14 during the Fairbanks flood. I ended up in the hospital, and they weren't admitting anybody unless they were on death's door. And at the Bassett Army Hospital, they saved my life. After which, I experienced my father hiring a secretary to manage his business, the day-to-day operations. She was married to an IRS agent, unbeknownst to him, and they set my dad up for a major financial calamity, in which case my dad wasn't aware of the fact that this was a ongoing situation until we were in king salmon fishing over by the Tick-Tick Lake system, and the checks were bouncing. Well, the IRS stepped in and seized his account. We're way the heck over on the western side of Alaska when this is going on. We're in Fairbanks operation. So they did all this so they could force my dad into a selling position, because he wasn't about to sell the state of Alaska distributorship for Kirby Company of Alaska.
Mr. McKee, could you summarize your comments? And
In summary, what happened is still ongoing. This structural organization is run by the Bar Association, and it's corrupt.
Thank you, Mr. McKee, for your testimony. Next testifier in the queue, Arika Paquette in Ketchikan. Ms. Paquette, if you could please put yourself on the record and present your testimony.
Hi, my name is Erica Paquette, and I'm the Prevention Manager for Women in Safe Homes and the Coordinator for the Villa Island Resilience Initiative here in Ketchikan. Our group is working to prevent trauma and promote resilience through collective action. The goal of my department and WISH is to prevent violence before it starts through primary prevention strategies. Research has shown that childhood trauma, including witnessing domestic violence in the home, is a risk factor for violence being experienced across the lifespan. Our programs typically target youth in elementary through high school, but oftentimes we are engaging in primary prevention too late because children are being impacted by adverse childhood experiences prior to entering the school system. We have found that cross-sector collaboration is instrumental in the implementation of effective strategies in our communities that create a measurable reduction in both the perpetration of violence and the victimization. Through the lens of the trauma-informed care, we are able to build connections between sectors to engage in projects or implement programs that impact multiple social problems, not just intimate partner violence and sexual violence prevention. Currently, we are working with our school district to support integrating a trauma-informed approach in all of our schools by helping teachers to identify, support, and promote healing among the victims of childhood trauma. We know that trauma is passed through generations, so supporting both parents and children is also critical in ending this epidemic. The state could further support these efforts by officially supporting local and statewide initiatives to encourage cross-sector collaboration to prevent all forms of childhood trauma and to build resilience in our families and communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Paquette, for presenting your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for taking the time today, and apologies for mispronouncing your name the first go-around. That concludes our offline, non-in-person testimony. I don't see anyone signed up here in Juneau, but I half wonder if that is in fact the case. Is there anyone here in the room to testify as a member of the public on HCR2? Please put yourself on the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Carmen Lowry, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, or the Network. The Network is constituted through 24 DBSA agencies across the state. We have been an active partner with the Alaska Legislature since 1980. We want to thank you for that continued partnership. The Network fully supports this resolution, and we deeply appreciate the call to establish statewide policies that address the devastating impacts of ACEs. And here's our part. In FY17, our programs responded to about 7,700 women who reached out for services. approximately 1,800 children. And the multiple studies that you've already heard about, the ones that have been done on ACEs conducted since 2000 are pretty clear. One, there are substantiated links between witnessing violence against your mother and then developing risk factors that have negative impacts for your well-being as an adult. And two, there are substantiated correlations between domestic violence and the likelihood that that child will be physically abused. The bottom line is that we know that children's exposure to domestic violence has a profound impact on children and that that reverberates into their adult life. And we know that these impacts and these reverberations have social and physical implications for the state. So in response to this resolution, here's what we and you can do together. One, to continue to support and provide life-saving shelter and emergency services to victims and their children. Two, to expand and learn from our community-based prevention activities. And then three, to assess the state policies we have in place now with an eye to what needs to be revised or created to adequately address those larger social factors that contribute to our current state, where 40% of our adult female population, their children, their partners, and their communities experience domestic violence. The network offers our full support in responding to this call from HCR2, and we encourage you to do the same. Thank you very much for listening and for this opportunity and for your service.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for coming in today. There were no amendments received by the deadline, so that takes us next to committee discussion on HCR2, and we'll let any member comment on the bill before possible action. Any comments? Representative Tuck.
Yeah, testimony is closed.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm closing public testimony now. Yeah, no other people signed up. Representative Tuck, do you have a comment?
Yes, I do. Well, I had no idea of what adverse childhood experiences were until Representative Tarr brought up a gentleman from California. And unfortunately, we were supposed to have a lunch and learn, I believe, on that, but it got canceled because of the things that were going on. But we did meet and discuss what it is, how people are affected by it, and some simple treatments even that help people overcome. And I will tell you, I was pretty amazed. It was pretty enlightening. And, I mean, just by asking people questions in their physical exam, just by asking people questions of who they are, what they're about, and some experiences can reduce significantly their health situation and improve their health situation. I mean, reduce the cost, but improve by improving the condition. And I actually happened to watch a YouTube video. I enjoy watching YouTube. And saw a TED Talk on a doctor who had talked about just he had some extra time. He had an older gentleman that came in, was spending that time with him, just asking about his personal life and everything else, but actually doing a full exam to where he checked his muscles, checked his, you know, his neck, his thyroid, check things, and just by that little bit of action, how much it made a difference in that, in his healing as well. And then he, of course, goes on talking about the importance of the medical field, finding out the history of people. I mean, they're much like detectives, he says, really getting into the core to really improve the overall health of people. And it goes back to the adverse childhood experiences, and I think just even awareness alone, I think will have high impact in our communities and our families. So I want to thank the sponsor for bringing it forward, and also I can't remember the gentleman's name. I think his last name started with a V or an F, but it was very high impact. Thank you.
Other comments from the committee, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was at that meeting too, and I'm not going to try to guess his name. Filetti. I knew his Italian name. No, he it was a very enlightening, and that a couple things here. One, we want to prevent the things that cause high ACEs scores. We also want to know how to deal with people that have already experienced that. So, you know, it's twofold. and also understand why a lot of people have difficulties that they do, this sort of helps explain some of it, and that simply asking questions and giving people a chance to explain what happened to them and does help. And also a byproduct is it saves a lot of expenditures that we're spending. So
thank you. Seeing no further comments, Representative Wohl, a motion.
I move HCR 2 version 30-LS0277/J from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing and hearing no objection, HCR 2 moves from committee. Thank you, Representative Tarr, and staff and testifiers for taking the time today. That takes us to the next item on today's agenda, HB.
Chairman, is it HJR?
CR, sorry, HCR is in, Connecticut. Second item on today's agenda, HB 168, married with also HCR, C is in Connecticut or Colonial 10. And Representative Chenault, Mr. Wright, and actually, I'm not sure any further comment required unless you have something to say. We noticed public testimony today, and I will go ahead and open it now. I don't see anyone online. Is there anyone in the room to testify on HB 168? Seeing none, I'm going to close testimony on HB 168. This takes the bill back before the committee. Is there any committee comment? There are also, I should add, no amendments submitted by deadline on this legislation. Any comments on this piece of legislation? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Never miss a chance to make a comment.
Quite loquacious.
I did serve on admin reg review for 2 years, and we never met once, so I have no further comment. That I don't think I'll be missing it.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did serve on administrative reg review as well, and I can think of two times where it had pretty good impact. One of them was when the Department of Commerce Community Economic Development was adopting regulations changing the Alaska Marine pilots' role and the length of the ships that required to come in here. We had a hearing on that, and it was actually those regulations were reversed. During that same year, we also had one on the real estate agents and their fees and where their fees were going and everything else, and had the administration explain themselves and had public testimony on that as well. And that also got reversed. And I think that there is a role for that. It may not be a role for it on a regular basis, but I have seen where it's been helpful. I can explain also that there's been recent regulations that's been drafted by the Alcohol Board that now is forcing us to put a bill through committee, which is costing a lot of money. Anything that isn't restricted in our statutes is implied to be allowed. That's just the way America works. And to put further restrictions when it wasn't the legislative intent, we sent two letters to the board on legislative intent with multiple signatures from the legislature. Had over 500 letters, but yet they still went rogue. So I think that one of the purposes of the administrative reg review is making sure the administration is doing legislative intent, and that's the way that we make them accountable. So I'm a little bit hesitant on taking them off the books so that if we need to spin up that committee, we can spin up that committee. I do, however, feel very comfortable with HCR 10, which allows the appropriate committee. But one of the nice things about the administrative reg review is it's a joint committee of both the House and the Senate. So that's how you get legislative intent out there, not just by one body or the other body. And so so that's my little bit of hesitance. I like the way it is right now. It's on the books. We don't necessarily need to spin it up, but if we need to spin it up, we can spin it up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other committee comments? Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I knew at some point in time Representative Tuck and I were going to find common ground on an issue, and we did on this one. I too think there's a place for it, and I appreciate his comments. I think he's right on in some cases, and I was reluctant on this, but I got to say that as long as it's been implemented and no more effective than it has been, I'm going to support the bill and the resolution, HCR 10. But with the caveat that I hope at some time in the future we talk about this again and implement something that will work for us. I think it is needed, as Representative Tuck said. And so I'm going to support this because it doesn't appear it's been a real effective tool. But I'm hoping we don't let this issue fall too far without addressing it in the future. Thank you.
Further committee comment? I'll throw a quick one in before a motion. I hear Representative Knopf's and Tuck's comments that note that seems maybe in part that will be spoken for with standing committees being able to exercise that oversight role, but that joint function, I guess, is a good point, and we'll have to, I guess, sort of see how things unfold. But, yeah, good thoughts. And at this point in time, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, the motion.
Yes, I move HB 168 version 30-LS0682/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes dated 2018.
Seeing and hearing no objection, HB 168 passes from committee, and that takes before us the companion legislation HCR 10. Go through the same routine, open public testimony, which was noticed today. I see no public testimony online. Is there any testimony in the room for HCR 10? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. That takes HCR 10 back before the committee. Is there any committee comment on HCR 10? And I guess we may have done two birds, one stone last go around. Seeing no comments from committee. Madam Vice Chair, a motion?
Yes, I move HCR 10 version 30-LS0683/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes dated 2018.
Seeing and hearing no objection, HCR 10 moves from committee. So that takes care of the second and third items on today's agenda. That takes us to the fourth item on today's agenda, HB 224 from Representative Johnston, who I saw came in and joined us, as well as staff, Ms. Liz Rexford. Today we have, if you will, reintroduction of the legislation, this being the first hearing in 2018, as well as any sponsor remarks. We also have invited testimony today, and we'll get to that after sponsor comments. But Representative Johnston, Ms. Rexford, please put yourself on the record and add any comments to refamiliarize us with the piece of legislation.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Jennifer Johnston, and with me is my aide, Elizabeth Rexford, and we're here to talk about HB 224, and it's the act relating to reemployment of persons who retire under the teacher's retirement system, and I will turn the mic over to my aide, Elizabeth Rexford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for hearing HB 224. HB 224 will reinstate the retire/rehire provision that was adopted in 2005 through HB 161, which had a sunset date in 2009. Alaska is experiencing a severe shortage of teachers, specialists, and administrators in our school districts throughout every region in Alaska. Attracting and retaining quality teachers has become a critical issue facing school districts as they work to improve education in Alaska's public schools. The bill gives school districts the flexibility to rehire retired teachers, which will expand the pool of qualified teachers to temporarily fill positions until a permanent teacher is rehired for that position. Currently, school districts are struggling to fill vacant positions with qualified teachers, sometimes relying on long-term substitutes and other replacements. This bill will provide another tool for school districts to address this problem in the short term while long-term solutions continue to be worked on. Thank you for taking the time to hear HB 224, and we have a couple of invited testifiers.
Wonderful. Very quickly, any questions from the committee for sponsor or sponsor staff while we have them? Representative Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This really isn't a question as much as a statement. I just really think this is, I'm always pleased to hear practical legislation, and I think this is something that's been sorely needed for a while, and I'm just really want to say thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Representative Johnston, Ms. Rexford. Our first invited testifier is Lisa Parody. Please come forward and present your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lisa Skiles Parody. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators, and in that capacity, I represent the Alaska superintendents, elementary principals, secondary principals, school business officials, and other school administrators. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this really important legislation. I also want to thank the sponsors for bringing forward this bill to help education. My testimony is being given with the full support of my colleague, Norm Wooten, from the Alaska Association of School Boards, who is also with us today. And I believe you received two resolutions that the AASB put forth from its membership as well in support of this bill. We are in strong support of House Bill 224 as one tool that will help school districts in a time where they need immediate help to attract leadership talent to the education profession. We recognize that this is not a silver bullet, but it can provide some relief. It is a tool. House Bill 224 would allow, as you heard, for the reemployment of retired educators to help districts fill vacancies and is a necessary tool to help meet school district personnel needs both in urban and rural districts. I want to thank Kathy Lee, who is in the audience as well. She's the Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits, the Department Administration. And since we were before you last year, we've been working with her over the year to ensure that what is before you now is in compliance with the IRS Treasury regulations that were supported by the Department of Administration, and those are in the current CS. We've also worked with NEA Alaska, who, also recognizing our critical shortage, supports this legislation with two minor changes, those being that the districts be able to show that they've tried to hire a qualified teacher but were unable to, and that the contract be for 1 year at a time. And both of those changes are easily amendable into the purposes of this proposed legislation. So I think it's kind of a rare opportunity when all of education is working together and is before you to ask for your help. This is a basic supply and demand issue. And to begin with, this legislation is vital because we do have such a critical shortage. And I want to talk just a little bit about that shortage because I think it's important that you understand some of the realities that districts are working with. Our members make the hiring decisions in each district and deal directly with the increasing difficulty of doing so today. I think there's several letters that you've received from districts as written testimony, and I hope you've had a second to read through those. As our organization works together, we, and I believe these were distributed to you in your packet, our joint position statements, but you'll see that we are very focused on preparing, attracting, and retaining qualified educators, and specifically looking at areas of innovation, alternative pathways, to attracting teaching and leadership talent. And every one of our members voted to try to explore this retire-rehire provision. So I just want to make the point that it's very well supported. Alaska reflects the national shortage of teachers and educators, but we're having even greater struggles because of our remoteness coupled with our loss of competitiveness. Against the backdrop of our national educator shortage, our retirement system and wages for the cost of living here does not draw from the lower 48 as it once did. And we recruit the majority of our teachers from the lower 48, so I like to say we're on steroids here with this problem because everyone's experiencing it, but ours is worse because we're so reliant on the lower 48 for our educators. It used to be, and some of you might remember this, that the Alaska Teacher Placement Job Fair, which is held every year in Anchorage, would attract hundreds of educators from across the country. Last year, the ATP job fair, there were more hiring personnel than applicants. I think they had a total of 211 registrants, with 172 of them from Alaska, so kind of rotating, between districts. 39 were from out of state. So it gives you some scale. There were 36 districts present. And to really put some definition on the shortage, I want to just share the numbers for superintendent, principal, and teachers. With superintendents, 24% of districts had a new superintendent last year, 2016-2017. So if you look at the years from 2013 to 2017, 72% of districts experienced at least one change of superintendents in that five-year period, 72%. Principals, we have approximately 400 principals in the state in 2016-2017. And so I want to make sure we're dealing with the definition of new. It means first time in a school, not necessarily a brand new principal, but it could be a new principal. But in this case, new just means first time in the school. So the teachers in that building are having a disruption in terms of a new principal. 26% of principals were new to their school in 2016-2017. And teachers, in 2016-2017, we had 8,010. The percent of teachers that are new to their school was 22%. But I want to look at retention, because that's where the numbers really get a little bit scary. Our average percent of teachers retained at Alaska schools was 72%. But when you start to break it down by locale, urban, which is like on and off the road, like Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau, is 83%. Urban fringe would be Palmer, Sitka, 76%. Rural hub, rural fringe, like Healy or Bethel, like a hub, is 71%. When you go to rural remote, which is 72% of our schools are off the road, like Arctic Village or Yakutat, 57% retention. So I think that gives you a really good picture. Clearly, retention is an issue in all locations in Alaska, and you can see in the most rural and remote schools where it is typically the most difficult to attract teachers, we're having the most severe retention problems. At the same time, you have a letter from Dr. Dina Bishop that you received today, the Anchorage School District superintendent, who shared with you how important this tool would be to her school district. So just in moving to close, I think many of you or some of you heard from Alaska University of Alaska President Jim Johnson, who testified this week to Joint Education Committee regarding the same, the teacher shortage issue, because the University of Alaska also understands this as an emergent issue and is taking specific actions to work with K-12 to create more teachers in Alaska. He's set an ambitious goal of preparing 90% of the annual hired teachers by 2025. And we really support and applaud this goal. However, we need assistance right now, and it's going to take time to grow our own. So the most pressing issue is unfilled vacancies after school starts. And that is directly what this bill is all about, really helping districts fill vacancies that have been advertised and have been unable to fill. There's no real specific system in place, but the Alaska teacher placement showed many unfilled jobs after school started this year, and I did put that in your packet. It looks like this, if you had a chance to take a look. I got these from the Alaska teacher placement yesterday, and it shows 486 openings. I do know that December we were trying to work with the University of Alaska to do some kind of emergency special education support piece, because we had, I believe, 93 vacancies in special education across Alaska. So I won't walk through these, but hopefully you can see, and I did ask them to break down the student support services, because that kind of gives you the special ed picture. The job bank is a live system only, and so as you watch it in the next couple months, as we move into recruitment season, you'll see around 800 positions opening and be posted. One other thought, and it really defies common sense, is that an individual can retire in any other state in America and come to Alaska and become employed without any problem. However, our own retired educators who committed their careers to our Alaska children are currently blocked from doing the same. So as you may know, and was mentioned, this law did sunset in 2009, and the Department of Administration provided me kind of a summary of the experience that we have with this program in the last go-around. And in the years between 2001 and 2010, total utilization was 325 retired, rehired. Average time reemployed was 18.7 months. The shortest period of reemployment was 3 months. The longest period of reemployment was 46 months. The employer employing the largest number was the Lower Kuskokwim School District, which is our largest rural district, and the highest number employed in 1 year was 181. The highest use was a teacher at 149. 45 special ed teachers used this. There were 18 superintendents. But a total 22 principals, but a total usage of 325. So again, this isn't opening the floodgates. This is targeting specific positions that we are not able to fill with potentially a retired teacher who might be in the community, who might be willing to come in and do a one-year contract and preserve that quality in the classroom, which I think we're all really focused on. So in closing, this measure will help us alleviate some of the pressure that districts feel in recruiting teachers, particularly in our high poverty and rural areas. Our students will benefit by experienced leadership and experienced Alaska teachers and educators working with new teachers to achieve a comprehensive learning program for all our students. So on behalf of our organization, we ask for your support of House Bill 224, and I thank you for your time and consideration. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I see a couple of questions. Representative Ledoux's hand was up first on my peripheral vision. Representative Ledoux.
I'm trying to figure this out. At some point, did we pass a law that forbid teachers from being rehired?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we have an expert in the audience from the Department of Administration, so I want to just make you aware that Kathy Lee is here and she can speak specifically in detail, but we do have prohibition past 0.49. So a retired person can only work up to 0.49 of a day.
Follow-up?
What was the rationale for that?
Mr. Chairman, I would I would ask that the Department of Administration speak to that because we were not involved at that time.
Sure. Is the Department of Administration here? Please come forward. Yes, please. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Please put yourself on the record, and if you can, speak to Representative Ledoux's question.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Lee. I'm the Deputy Director, Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, there is a law on the books that prohibits a retired member from coming back into full-time service or part-time service if it's over 50% of the normal work week. And that is in Section 1425043. It's a standard provision in retirement plans that once you initiate your retirement benefit that you're not working and receiving an active salary from an employer in the same plan that you retired from.
So,
follow up,
thank you. So besides it being standard, why do we do it? What do you remember? I mean, when did we do it? And do you remember the rationale for why we did it?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, this has been on the books since probably the 1950s. I would need to go back and look in the history, but the reason it's done is for the perception of double dipping, where somebody has earned a retirement but is still working. There are IRS rules that require a bona fide termination of employment before you can come back to work for the same employer. Mostly it's protection of the plan.
Follow-up?
Of the retirement plan?
Through the chair of Representative Ledoux, yes, of the retirement plan. Because if you have provisions for retirees to come back into service, then there's a potential for contributions to that plan to be lost because you don't have new enrollees in the plan that are paying contributions. In this case, under this bill, contributions are required, so that keeps the plan whole.
So just, so I notice there's no fiscal note. Does that mean that it doesn't have any fiscal impact on the state, one way or the other?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there's no fiscal note at this time because we have not yet ordered a fiscal note. There will need to be a fiscal analysis. We look to the leadership of both the House and the Senate to tell us which bills we should order fiscal notes on, and we've not received a request for this bill. This bill does require the employer to pay the employer contributions for these members, and it also requires them to offer the active health insurance. So those are two areas that create cost. So I can't say the fiscal note would be zero, but I can say that there are elements in this bill that address those cost concerns.
Just follow up. So what you just said was sort of interesting to me. So fiscal notes don't happen unless the leadership of the House or the Senate asks for a fiscal note?
Yes, ma'am. Oops, excuse me. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. Yes, ma'am. This has been in effect for a couple years now. And the reason for this is the actuarial analysis is very high in cost. It is not a cost that can be paid from the trusts themselves. It has to be paid from the general fund. And we get a general fund budget amount every year. And so it's managed by the leadership.
Thank you. And actually, you can take a brief at ease to sort out a fiscal note that might be circulating on this subject.
Okay.
Actually, I believe there is a fiscal note associated with this bill that's in members' packets. Indeterminate. And I believe Representative Ledoux now has it.
Yeah, I do have it. I'm sorry I didn't see it previously. Okay, thank you.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony this afternoon. One question I had, there was actually a couple questions, but one related to there's a provision here that says the district has to certify that the member in the school district did not arrange before the member retired from the school district and the member is to be reemployed by the school district. Does that have a basis in the plan somehow through the chair, or is that?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, that's an Internal Revenue Service requirement. It's to prevent what they term an in-service distribution. So they want to make sure when you draw your retirement benefit that you've had a bona fide termination of employment.
Gotcha. Okay. And then follow up. Thank you for that clarification. Secondly, does the actuarial, whoever it is that evaluates how much liability the state of Alaska under PERS or TERS has, you know, whatever that number is, does this impact that liability one way or the other, depending on, and I just don't know. I mean, obviously we got a fiscal note that relates to, I presume that's to the direct out of, you know, the direct cost and budget impacts, but is this a net gain or loss to the liabilities that the state would otherwise have in their you know, kind of the PERS TERS liability. And I just don't know who does that assessment, or if we go back in some way or another to determine whether or not this increases the liability or leaves it or holds it the same.
Through the chair, Representative Birch. First, an apology to Representative Ledoux. I may have expressed myself incorrectly. There is a fiscal note on this bill, but not a fiscal analysis, an actuarial analysis. And the reason for that is, yes, that's what has to be ordered by the leadership. And until we get that actuarial analysis done, we don't know what the impact on the fund itself will be. Those are performed by the division's consulting actuary, which is Conduent Incorporated at this time. And once we get an order for a fiscal analysis of this type, they will do the analysis of what the potential impact in the future will be on the plan funding itself.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, typically there's a requirement for at least in many that I'm aware of, there's a requirement for a union membership and dues assessment. Does that happen as well on a rehire provision? Does that apply across the board, or is that obligation disappear when it's on a rehire? Right.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, that's outside of my purview, so I can't answer that question.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Knopp, and I think maybe a couple more questions, and then I want to be sure to get to our other invited testifier, Anne-Marie O'Brien. Representative Knopp, yeah.
Thank you for that, and a little bit towards what Representative Ledoux asked you. I do remember back in the local government days of a lot of what you call double dipping. People retirement never left the seat, and then that's where that IRS determination, I remember some of that being discussed then. We even at one point used to exempt some administration positions out of the PERS and keep them employed so they could retire, take their pension, and not lose a paycheck. I remember a lot of that happening. But as I read this bill, here comes my question. As I read this, the PERS contributions are still required as if it was filled permanently, but the member now filling that under temporary rehire is no longer eligible for additional benefits through the PERS system, but they must still contribute, or the department, the district will still contribute on their behalf. So I would think that, in a sense, it will be a net gain to the retirement system. Do I have that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, it isn't necessarily a net gain, because if there had been a permanent teacher hired in that position, those contributions would have been made as well. So it's more of a wash.
But would they not been then distributed? They've been distributed back out some point in the future. So now they're not eligible for redistribution to that individual. So in my mind, that's a net gain to the system.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, it would be a de minimis amount.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. This time, we'd like to call forward Anne-Marie O'Brien, the other invited testifier. There we are. And in light of time, ask if you could limit your testimony to 3 minutes.
Yes, Chairman Kreese Tompkins and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. For the record, I'm Dr. Anne-Marie O'Brien, Superintendent of the Northwest Arctic Borough School District. We have 2,136 students in 12 schools in our 11 villages. None of our village sites are accessible by roads, and all supplies are delivered via an air carrier. I've been employed in Northwest Arctic for 18 years, 6 as Director of Curriculum and Instruction, 8 years as Assistant Superintendent, and now in my 4th year as Superintendent. This message is a request to all legislators to approve, before the end of this session, House Bill number 224, and act relating to reemployment of persons who retire under the teacher's retirement system. Rural Alaska, especially Western Alaska, is in a crisis due to the shortage of qualified staff to teach our students. For the first time in all my years in Northwest Arctic, school opened without full staffing. And as we recruit for the 2018-19 school year, the situation is projected to be worse. As parents and grandparents, I know this situation would be unacceptable to you. As you know, Alaska University System graduates a fraction of the teachers needed to fill open positions throughout the state. The in-state candidates are in high demand and mainly seek positions on the road system. This further decreases the number of candidates for rural Alaska. And as a result, the district, as many districts do, go through great expense to recruit in the lower 48. With the entire country facing a teacher shortage, the district must continually seek out new areas from which to recruit. Utah, for example, no longer allows out-of-state recruiters to attend their major education career fairs. Others, such as the state of Montana, allow in-state recruiters to speak with their candidates first and try to gently discourage out-of-state recruiting. In an environment of ever-shrinking resources, we are asking for assistance. As a district, we are taking advantage of the technology available to grow and expand our programs. We are trying to use our staffing as effectively as possible during this time of teacher shortage. Using a video teleconference system, the district has been able to offer electives to remote sites that do not have the staff to support additional courses. Currently, there are 8 sites and 61 students taking these classes in our district. In addition to that, there are 3 students from 2 villages outside our school district who are enrolled in Introduction to Education 1, along with our students. The education focus is a result of an active Educators Rising program. Currently, there are 14 students enrolled in internships in 4 of our schools. This Introduction to Education classes uses Canvas as a lesson management platform. 35 students enrolled in Introduction to Education 1 course this year. This course was only offered via VTC and is available to all sites. So we are doing our best to grow our own and to support. These are dual credit classes. We also run a 40-bed high school dormitory available to 11th and 12th grade students locally and statewide. We house both full-time students as well as students who travel to Kotzebue for our variable length programs. These programs, offered through our magnet school, are designed to introduce students to careers in healthcare, education, process technology, and culinary arts. This efficiently allows us to fill the need for classes in these areas to students in schools outside of Kotzebue that do not have the staffing or students to make the course viable. We maintain our quality instruction through offering distance delivery and our magnet school boarding program, but it is not enough. House Bill 224, I was under the impression when I wrote this, has no fiscal impact. I guess that is uncertain at this time, but it will favorably impact district finances by reducing costs associated with the recruitment efforts in the lower 48 and our students by having full-time, not temporary, teachers for their classes. I am appealing to all members of the legislature to assist districts struggling with maintaining qualified staff for the students in rural Alaska. Please approve House Bill 224 before the end of this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Brien. And with that, we will hold this bill. It has been noticed next Thursday, and we're working with the sponsor's office to incorporate some amendments that were noted in previous testimony, and a CS will circulate to all committee members as soon as it's prepared. Assuming that CS has adequate time to circulate, and which I believe is going to be the case, I'm setting an amendment deadline for Wednesday, February 14th at 5 p.m. for this piece of legislation in advance of the Thursday hearing and possible committee action if that's the will of the committee. Thank you very much, Mr. Bryan, for your testimony. And I'd also like to recognize members of the Northwest Arctic Borough School Board for joining us today.
Thank you.
That takes us to the final piece of legislation on today's agenda, HJR 31. Although I do want to note, while we're talking about amendment deadlines, HB 293 relating to background checks for police and training has also been noticed today, and that will be heard next Thursday, and setting an amendment deadline for Wednesday, February 14th at 5 p.m. for that piece of legislation as well.
If I may, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Tuck.
So House Bill 293, is this the first hearing?
Which bill?
House Bill 293, would you just notice to be on Thursday next week?
No, it's the Village Police Officer APSC bill that we've heard previously.
That's House Bill 293.
293,
okay,
yes.
Wednesday at
5 p.m.
5 o'clock.
Yeah.
As well as this other one. Okay.
Yes, that's right. So this takes us to... Oh, Representative Ledoux.
So was that notice for today?
Nope, that was notice for next week.
For next week, but at 5 p.m.?
The hearing next week is on Thursday, and the amendment deadline is 5 p.m. the day before.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. HJR 31, and we have noticed public testimony for HJR 31 today. And looking in the queue, first we have... I'm going to open public testimony, go off net, and we'll limit testimony, as we always do, to 2 or less minutes. Leon James in Anchorage, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Leon Hynes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify as a private citizen in support of House Joint Resolution number 31. I have enjoyed a career of nearly 20 years in the field of information technology, and I currently work as an information security consultant and certified information security incident handler. I hold 5 additional certifications in network firewalls and data center virtualization technology. And in the past several years, I've worked on the networks of over 60 distinct organizations, including state and local governments, healthcare organizations, telecom, banking and finance industry, retail, and hospitality. During my career in IT, as both a business and individual customer of Internet service providers, I've watched Internet service providers capitalize on consumer demand in the form of data caps and long-term contracts and termination fees, and at times manipulation of Internet traffic, as we saw with Comcast throttling BitTorrent traffic in 2008. I have an expert understanding of the network architectures and technology that allow service providers to accomplish these feats. And I have direct knowledge of technical configurations used by Internet service providers to configure their provider networks. I support net neutrality, and I believe that open and free access to the Internet is fundamental to democracy. I believe that net neutrality ensures a level playing field for small businesses, individual entrepreneurs, and private citizens. I also believe that net neutrality is vital to ensuring the capability to limit free speech is not something that is even a capability available to Internet service providers. I believe that Alaska is unique in that innovation utilizing network connectivity to the global economy is a vital and untapped resource that can fuel economic growth in Alaska. Net neutrality facilitates and protects that opportunity for Alaskans. Across the board, one thing that the majority of networks that I've worked in have in common is the inability to keep pace with information security threats. I'm inclined to say that it's not even close. The lack of information security controls often borders on negligence, and it is truly alarming. My biggest concern with net neutrality is that it opens the door to capturing more sensitive and personal data about consumers by Internet service providers. Currently, an Internet service provider can capture data under the auspices of troubleshooting, and we can consider this phone call one of those pieces of data as an example. It is digitized and transmitted via the standard IP networks, and right now the data packets that comprise phone calls, text messages, and multimedia SMS messages are very likely being captured for troubleshooting purposes.
And if you could please summarize your comments.
Oh, sure. I guess in summary, my concern is that the ISPs don't have the capability to secure the data that they would capture if net neutrality is left unrepealed, and that the more data that is collected on consumers, if the data is collected, it can be stolen, and once it's stolen, there's no way to recover it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time to testify. Moving on, also in Anchorage, Tara Rich, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. So again, for the record, my name is Tara Rich, and I'm the Legal and Policy Director of the ACLU of Alaska. And I wanted to testify today just to bring to your attention a couple of instances in which some of the primary concerns of the ACLU, and that is the censorship that ISPs or internet service providers or other telecom companies could have on internet users, actually taking place throughout the country. It's noted in my letter, but we've noted several different examples, including AT&T having censored a live Pearl Jam concert in response to criticisms of President George W. Bush by the band's leader, lead singer Eddie Vedder. In 2007, Verizon blocked text messages from the pro-choice advocacy group NARAL because Verizon deemed them to be, quote-unquote, controversial. TLUS, the Canadian telecom company, had blocked the website of a union with which it was engaged in a labor dispute. And there are numerous other examples of telecom companies using these sorts of mechanisms that would have been regulated under net neutrality, that is, using tools like blocking certain websites, what you hear called throttling, meaning intentionally slowing down the access to the data, or paid prioritization for certain groups or certain websites, and that we have very severe concerns about it, you know, inhibiting the free speech in the internet as we know it today. The internet plays a very special role for free speech. It is decentralized. It's neutral. Right now it is non-discriminatory. It takes information from source to destination and promotes open discourse. It allows people from their homes to have an equal chance to be seen and heard. The Supreme Court has even recognized any person with a phone line can become a town crier with a voice that resonates farther than it could from any soapbox. We've seen it really change the way that we talk to one another and the information that we get on a day-to-day basis.
And Ms. Rich, if you could please summarize your testimony.
Sure. I just wanted to encourage the members to think about this as this is going through. We have heard that the two ISPs in Alaska have indicated that they don't intend to abuse it. The one thing I wanted to bring up to the committee members' attention about that is that that may not matter. The reason for that is peering agreements, that even if we, even if our local ISPs, GCI, and others do not intend to violate net neutrality rules, we may be at the mercy of what other ISPs, Comcast, Verizon, or Time Warner would do, and we have no control over that because we use the networks that they use throughout the lower 48. And I want to thank the committee for giving me the chance to testify. The rest is in my written comments.
Thank you very much, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned two ISPs, but nationally, I think there's certainly multiple ISPs and service options for a consumer. Are there not? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, that's correct. The two ISPs I was referring to are the main two providers for internet service in Alaska.
I'm not supportive of this resolution, and I guess the reason why is, you know, I think we let the, you know, I have a much faith in the commercial markets and the competitive nature of, if you're unhappy with a level of service from a provider or somebody that's that you're using, you move on to a competitor. And to that extent, I mean, I think the public certainly protected from that regard. And as far as the level of use, you know, I spent 9 years on an electric utility board, and you know, I mean, everybody's got a wire into their house, but we charge different rates based on how much electricity you use. And I guess I kind of struggle with the idea that we ought to be, you know, immersing ourselves in the in the commercial market here. And I look forward to learning more, but I do appreciate your testimony and comments.
I'm going to use that as a segue into the comments on the piece of legislation as a whole, and thank you, Ms. Rich, for testifying. I'm also mindful that the UA Finance Subcommittee is starting in 4 minutes and don't want to put the subcommittee's chair behind schedule. Any comments on HJR 31 now being before the committee? Representative Knopp.
So, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I thought I was in full support of this, and I believe I still am, you know. But staff, as well as other emails I received, I think I got one from Americans for Tax Revolt or something there, not supporting it, meaning I think their intent was saying, Mr. Chairman, that every state should not adopt their own net neutrality laws. It gets like the Uber thing, you know, around the country. But then the staff brought to my attention today that if you don't have this, what happens if you have, say, an ISP provider, we'll use one of the common ones here, has a nice relationship with Netflix, but not with one of the other ones. They will slow one down, favor the other one. So I think I'm still supportive of it, but there are things I'm still learning about and trying to understand it fully. So I just throw that out there. If any other members of the committee has got an opinion on it, I think it's worked well as it was when everybody had equal and fair access. So I'm not sure I'm supportive of a change to it.
Thank you. And Kathy, just the committee just passed a note that I need to close public testimony, which I'll do so now, often catching my mistakes. Thank you, Kathy. Other committee comments? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out that Representative Kopp and I actually agree on a lot of stuff. I don't know what we don't agree on, but we do agree on a lot of stuff. And this is one of those other situations. You know, when we look at infrastructure has to be for the common good, and has to be regulated. I mean, our power is regulated. Our telecommunications have been broken down, but then building back up again, and it's because we rely on that infrastructure for advancing societies, making progress, and making sure that our business and economy are thriving. And you know, the testimony that we heard from the first person today, talking about how, you know, it's really economic opportunities. It's a vital resource for that. And I know of my cell phone that when I use a lot of data, I get charged for it, just the same way as I use a lot of electricity, I get charged for it. But what's nice about with the net neutrality is I can access whatever I want to access based on that information highway, and I like to keep that open for consumers. It's a good consumer bill.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Representative Wohl, a motion?
I move HDR 31, version 30-LS1312/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you. And
in 2018.
Seeing and hearing no objection. Oh, there's an objection. Madam Secretary, would you call the roll?
Yes.
Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Representative Burke?
No.
Representative Johnson? Not here. Representative Tuck?
Yes.
Representative Knopf?
Yes.
Chair Chris Tompkins?
Yes.
So that's 5 yeas, 1 nay.
And by a vote of 5 yeas and 1 nay, HJR 31 passes from committee. I should note that in terms of legislation being passed next or heard next week and associated amendment deadlines, we will also send that out by email for members' reference. Three new pieces of legislation next week and six bills total on the agenda. UA Finance Subcommittee next, and we will reconvene next Tuesday, February 13th. State Affairs is adjourned at 4:30.